Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means it is time for the Week in Review, and this week we are going to school.
It's time to give our kids a sense of normalcy and lift the mask mandate on a statewide basis for schools.
Governor Baker says masks are optional come the end of the month in schools. Local districts can make their own calls, though. And some, like Chelsea, say not so fast.
Our mask mandate still remains.
Chelsea Superintendent Almy Abeda there. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu says Boston also keeping the masks for now.
The city of Boston is not ready to lift our mask mandate, and so ours will stay in place for the time being.
Also in Boston, a superintendent search begins. Again.
Dr. Brenda Casilius announcing she's leaving her job at the end of the school year, despite having 2 years left on her contract.
WCVB's Matt Reed there. So, Mayor Wu, did you ask Superintendent Casilius to leave?
No.
Meanwhile, in the world of higher education, multiple institutions in Boston grapple with allegations of misconduct and a culture of circling the wagons.
Harvard ignored these reports for years.
That is one of three Harvard graduates suing the university for its lack of response to student complaints. All of that and a surprise guest appearance at the end of the hour that you will not want to miss. So let's get right down to it. Join the conversation. We start in local schools. Are you on board with the governor's move to lift the school mask mandate? Do you know what your local school district is doing in response? And when is it time to take masks off in schools? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston to join the conversation. Joining us this week, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress, and media analyst John Carroll. Richard, welcome back.
Nice to be here. And thanks,
John,
for having me.
Great to have you. And John, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
All right. So it is clear that this is an issue in which reasonable people can and do disagree when it's time to take masks off in schools. So Governor Baker says the mandate that went through February 28th, not going to extend it. Richard Tessay, the right call?
I think the right call. I think there are people who would have preferred that the governor said it's over immediately rather than waiting until the 28th. And I agree with you. I mean, I think people get very emotional on both sides of the issue. But at the end of the day, you're basically giving people the option, rather than mandating everybody has to wear a mask, you're giving communities, a lot of, flexibility. And even in the schools that remove the mask mandate, you still have the option of wearing a mask if you want. So I think it's time.
So John Carroll, the CDC run by Rochelle Walensky, who it's worth noting is a local area resident, is not in the same place. But Governor Charlie Baker says we can keep kids safe here and keep them learning in schools. Here he is.
From education to public health, our administration will continue to make sure kids are learning safely in the classroom because that's where they learn best.
So at this point, John Carroll, how much should local realities, local data, whether you're looking from federal, local being the state level, or here in the state, Governor Baker saying, hey, school districts, schools can choose to do their own thing. How much is that the right call now?
Well, I think it's a Rorschach test. All the way around, you have conflicting opinions, you have conflicting data, you've got unequal levels of vaccination. So, the question is, how far down the ladder do you want to go in terms of making decisions? Does every single school in the Boston school system, for instance, make a decision? Or does the Boston Public Schools make a decision overall? You've got varying degrees of infrastructure throughout the public school system. And it has diverse impacts on different communities that are at a disadvantage. So I think that this is going to be difficult because not only is it a cultural issue, but it's also a public health issue. And there's going to be a really wide range of opinions about this. And I think it's going to be an area of significant conflict for a lot of people.
So, Richard, to say, picking up on John's idea of the Rorschach test versus science there, I want to play two pieces of sound. First, yesterday, Mayor Wu explaining her decision about masking in Boston schools during a budget press conference. Here she is.
In many of our spaces, for example, in the Boston Public Schools, not only is it tighter physical space because our classrooms can be quite crowded, but there are larger vaccination gaps among our youngest students especially.
Okay, so there she is talking about vaccination gaps among students. But here she is back in October in a televised mayoral debate on WCVB, and Ed Harding is asking her, back then when the governor was saying a school could start taking masks off it wanted if at least 80% of everyone in the school was vaccinated. Have a listen.
If Boston schools reach 80% vaccination rate, should masks be dropped? Councillor Wu, start with you.
No.
So there she is saying, even if we reached 80% vaccination rate, I'm not taking masks off. So what should one expect? And is it problematic to hear both of those things? Wu candidate, Wu mayor.
Well, I think a lot of people, that's the whole issue. I mean, there's so much contradictory guidance being given out by the CDC. I mean, they're originally saying you don't need to wear a mask, you do. It just changes so much. And Erin, with the mayor, I mean, the goalposts keep changing. And I think a lot of people have, you know, went into this, if you remember, you know, 2 weeks to spread, you know, to stop the curve. And now here we are 2 years later. And I guess it's easy to put the mandates in place, but it's going to be really tricky. And a lot of people don't want to let go and don't know when the right time to let go is, as far as trying to get back to normal. And I think the mayor in particular is really backing herself into a corner, not only with a mask mandate, but with the passports and the, you know, the vax policy. You know, the public is moving a lot quicker right now than the government is. And, you know, we look at all the different states around the country, look at all the communities in Massachusetts just over the last couple of days that have lifted the, lifted the COVID restrictions and state of emergency. So I think, you know, I think she should probably, if Cambridge is out there in Somerville and they don't have, passports, and the same type of restrictions that Boston has, I think that should tell a lot of people something.
So
you would think those communities are usually ahead of Boston.
And I do want to note there, and then I want to go to an interesting caller that we have, but I want to note there that Mayor Wu has laid out, and I'm going to say I don't have the metrics at my fingertips, but Mayor Wu has laid out metrics that she would use to lift things like the vaccine requirement, proof of vaccination requirement in businesses like restaurants and indoor entertainment spaces and local gyms. And just for listeners, there were some other cities and towns like Cambridge and Somerville that at first looked like they were going to follow suit with Mayor Wu and then didn't. Salem, however, did, just as a compare and contrast. Okay, I want to go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Mary calling from Boston, but I don't think this is just any Mary. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Mary Najimi. I'm the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Glad to talk to you. You know, this is an issue that we have been dealing with for 2 years of the pandemic. There's no doubt that all educators want to return to as much normalcy as possible. But to do it safely, we cannot throw caution to the wind and drop the mask mandate the day that students return from February vacation. We have enough experience with school vacations to know that those are periods where we've seen surges.
So, Mary, such a great opportunity to ask you this. Let's say that February 28th were a date where there hadn't been a school vacation beforehand. And I know school vacation is a complicating factor because families may go far and wide and into communities with other kinds of vaccination rates, mask policies, et cetera. Would that change the view of the Massachusetts Teachers Association about the governor not extending the mandate past February 28th?
It may or may not. There's many factors that we have to consider. Number one is vacation, but we also, it's far more prudent to wait until at least early, if not late March, and watch what's happening to the infection rates and the hospitalization rates when those drop. What's happening with the vaccination rates when those go up? Because what the governor ignores when he touts the vaccination rates in Massachusetts is that they vary dramatically from community to community. And this is an issue of racial justice. It is our communities of color with low-income background that have consistently had the lowest rates of vaccinations and the highest rates of COVID. So we, Mayor Wu is on the right track, looking at multiple metrics that we have to keep an eye on, and then we can judge when the time is right based on some of the metrics that I just named.
So let me just turn to John Carroll and Richard to say and ask if either of you have a follow-up comment or question to Mary Najimi. We weren't expecting Mary's call. I'm delighted that you did call Mary. So Richard or John, follow-up thoughts for Mary Najimi.
Well, I think the governor did look at the metrics, and that's why he decided to move forward. And again, I think a lot of people were frustrated. It's taken them that long. But if you just look, you know, at the number of infections among public schools, you know, in the week of January 6th, there were 51,000. The week of February 10th, there was 6,700. So the numbers are clearly going in the right direction right now. And, you know, when you're talking about kids in general, the danger, if you just go by CDC guidelines, you know, a kid has more of a chance of dying, drowning in a swimming pool or being in a car accident last year than they did from COVID. So, you got to weigh everything and the damage that's being done to kids by not being in the classroom, you know, and not being in a normal, having gone through this for the last 2 years.
So, Mary, I'm going to give you a chance to respond there quickly.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of people who are not actually educators and in the classroom are talking about the damage to kids when actually educators have a real pulse on what's happening. Educators are highly in tune to their students' mental health, more so than the commissioner, the governor, and some of these public health experts. We all have important opinions, including educators. Let me just quickly tell you, yesterday I spent the day visiting the Ipswich Public Schools, and what some of the high school students have been saying to their teachers is they're worried about the mask mandate because they're still afraid of catching it or their peers or their educators catching COVID. They're worried that if there's another outbreak, they go into remote learning again, and that was damaging to their mental health, far more damaging than wearing a mask, and they're worried that if you take the mask down, you can never get it back up. I spent the morning also in the elementary school. I went into almost every single classroom. There was a lot of joy going on in learning, despite the fact that they had masks on. So before people make these broad proclamations about how kids are managing, talk to educators and get their opinion as one more data point to inform decisions.
Okay.
That is something the governor and the commissioner have refused to do the whole time.
Okay, Mary Najimi, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, is a caller there. Mary, I'm going to put you on the spot right now and ask you, can we reach out to you to come back on the show next week and talk with us a little more?
Please do. I am more than happy to be back and spend the hour with you.
Great. Thank you, Mary. I appreciate that. So
you're welcome.
So. So, John Carroll, I'm going to come back to you in just a minute, but because Mary Najimi was saying talk to educators, we have an educator who has also called in, 1-800-423-8255, Dave in West Roxbury. So, Dave, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a middle school teacher, so I am an educator. I work in a fairly large urban district south of the city. First of all, she's right. A lot of kids are not going to take their masks off right away initially, and not always because of COVID, by the way. Some kids have grown accustomed to wearing one, and they're using it almost, especially in middle school, to kind of hide a little bit. And that's a bad word to use, but it's the best way to describe it. You know, it gives them a sense of anonymity. You know, that, you know, ignore me, I have a mask on, you can't tell me, and now you're going to tell me to take it off. So a lot of kids are going to leave their mask on for that reason, too.
Dave, thanks
but
for that.
Still need to
I appreciate that. And that gives me a chance to jump to a couple of experts that we talked to earlier this week. Here is Professor Dana Bentley, Lesley University, telling us about how kids have actually adapted developmentally to masks. Here she is.
It's taken a lot of work working with the kids, learning how to read the tone of someone's voice, learning how to read someone's eyes. But the driving force with young children and really with all children is a social force. They want to be together. They want to connect with each other. They want to read each other's social cues. And I've really been amazed at their ability to do so.
So John Carroll, you know, to what extent do the kids lead us, and to what extent are they caught between different adult interpretations of what they want, what they need, what is good for them, what we do and don't know, and how do we crack that nut?
Well, it's obviously not easy. One of the ways to look at this is by age. So the vaccination rates for children in Massachusetts between 5 and 11 is 51%. You know, when you get to 12 to 15, it's 83%. 16 to 19, it's 82%. So we can't even really just talk about schools. You know, we need to talk about the different levels of schools, and also, you know, take into account, you know, the emotional maturity and the ability to deal with these complicating and conflicting situations that the kids bring to the situation. So I think it's difficult to generalize. I think, you know, in each case, you have to look and see what's the safety level for the age group, and then what's the ability to adapt for the age group. And both of those are going to play a big part, I think, in what happens going forward.
Thank you, John. I'm just going to take a second to look back over my shoulder. Earlier, I mentioned that Mayor Wu had laid out some metrics for when she would lift some of the other COVID measures in the city of Boston. She told reporters that the city plans to repeal the requirements around vaccine proof in restaurants and other indoor venues, for example, once Boston's hospitalization and COVID rates are below 3 metrics, less than 95% of adult ICU beds are occupied, less than 200 daily COVID hospitalizations, and a positivity rate below 5%. So there are the metrics. Richard, to say, we've had a lot of chat since the last time you weighed in, so I'm just going to turn the mic back to you.
Well, no, she also said that once those metrics go up again, the passport would go into effect. So, you know, businesses right now in Boston, a lot of businesses I've talked to a couple of business owners, a restaurant owner in particular, they're really suffering right now with this passport. And given everything that they've been through the last 2 years, to have this, you know, to have her taking a hard line on the whole passport issue right now, when communities and the rest of the country are taking a step back, it really hurts. So, you know, you need some predictability, and, you know, if you're running a business, and just people want to get back to normal.
So
again.
Therein lies part of the rub, Richard, and I want to stay engaged with you on this for a second. A couple of weeks ago, we had Dr. Ashish Jha, who's the dean of the Brown School of Public Health, on, basically talking about the fact that we were likely going to need to dial up and dial down measures depending on levels of infection, hospitalization rates, et cetera. I hear you saying we cannot dial up and dial down because it is disruptive to people's sense of normalcy. But what if that is the public health approach that works?
Well, is this the, I guess you got to ask yourself, is this the new normal? Are kids going to be in masks in school forever? You know, are we going to every winter go back to issuing, you know, passports and vaccination mandates? What is the new normal going to be? And I think you're starting to see a reaction from people who have been very patient for 2 years, who are looking around and saying, enough is enough. I want to get back to a normal life. I don't want my kids to have to wear a mask every day in school. I want to be able to go out and, you know, get back to what life was like before all this happened. And that's, I think, what we're dealing with right now. The public is a lot further ahead than the government right now, and it's just accelerating. I would predict within a week or two, you know, to have a passport system in place in Boston is going to be untenable, given how fast everything is moving.
1-800-423-8255. We've got Gretchen on the line in Needham. Gretchen, go ahead. Hi, Gretchen. Do we still have you? Okay, I'll go back to the phones in a minute then. So, John Carroll, let me turn back to you. I'm going to stay on the masking in schools for just a minute longer. And then before we go to break, I do want to pick up on the question of the superintendent of schools in Boston as well. This idea that it is hard to live with a new normal where, yes, we're wearing masks, now we're not wearing masks. You know, yes, we proof of vaccination is going to matter. No, we're safe. It's not going to matter. Richard said it depends on whether you think this is the new normal. John, do you think this is the new normal?
Well, there's no going back to the old normal, I don't think. Whether this is exactly the new normal is a different question. I mean, one of the things, it's definitely been difficult for a lot of businesses over the past 2 years. But one of the things that's going to make it more difficult is you lift these mandates, and then all of a sudden, individual businesses are going to be making decisions that are going to be opposed by some segment of the population. And it's going to, the culture war, I think, is going to be ramped up even more. In a way, the mandates help businesses because they take them out of the equation. You know, they don't have a choice. They're not making this decision. And in a way, that can, you know, sort of keep the peace to some degree.
You know, it's interesting. We had the Thursday before the vaccination proof requirement went into effect. We had Mayor Wu here on the show, John, and that was part of her argument to me, was it would make it easier on businesses if it was just a blanket requirement in the city versus left to the discretion of the business owner. That was part of her argument.
So I'm channeling the mayor, which is always a good thing, I think. This is a balancing act that's really hard to get right. And it's going to be trial and error, I think, for a while. And that is going to be ramping up, ramping down to see what actually works in the interest of everybody from a public safety standpoint and from an economic standpoint.
All right, so I'm going to grab a couple calls here, and then we will shift gears. So we've got Paul on the line in Marshfield. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm just going to say we've got some people demonstrating in front of Roche Brothers in Marshfield here saying unmask the children and they can't breathe. And the doctors that I've heard, the reputable ones, say that it's physiologically negligible. It only reduces their oxygen by 1%. And the other thing is, earlier this year, it was Governor Baker himself that said when a school has 80% of the children vaccinated and staff that they can take off the mask. In Massachusetts, we don't have that, even though it might be like 76.7. Everybody wants COVID to go away. I want COVID to go away. But I think we should follow the science. Otherwise, we just keep stirring it up forever.
Thanks for the call, Paul. I'm going to grab one more here. We've got Caitlin in Franklin. Caitlin, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a teacher in a public school in suburban Metro West, and I'm also a mother of 3 school-aged children. And my hesitation comes from, first of all, the mask mandate being lifted right after the vacation, and also I think there should be more emphasis placed on wastewater data rather than the positivity rates. And also, the other concern I have is testing in schools, that it's very inconsistent across the board. And, you know, we're not always sure about how many cases are floating around in the school.
All right. Thanks for those calls. Those points, Caitlin. And I do want to kind of note, and then let's move into Caselius for just a minute. But it has been interesting. Massachusetts, the wastewater tracking at Deer Island has been an interesting lead indicator as to cases of COVID here in the region, and has actually become something that other communities around the country, and WBUR has reported on this, are watching and intrigued by. You know, a year ago, well, let's be honest, 2 years ago, if you had told me that a key metric for public health that we'd be tracking, like everyone would know about it, was wastewater, Richard, to say, I would have been doubtful of that. So I wonder, you know, a year from now, what are we going to be tracking and caring about that we're not imagining now?
Who knows? Then we might be dealing with another variant at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very emotional subject. People feel strongly on both sides, but, you know, life is a series of risks that you take. And, you know, I think the sooner we can kind of get the yoke of you know, the whole pandemic off of our shoulders and start to move ahead, the better off we're going to be.
All right. So, John Carroll, I do want to turn for a minute. Brenda Caselius will be resigning as the superintendent of Boston Public Schools, 2 years remaining on her contract. She has said, and the mayor have said, didn't ask her to leave, and that she's all in for the remaining few months. But this will be the sixth superintendent in the last, 16 years. That's a lot. So your reactions to this news, is it just what it is? Is it a bad thing? Is it fine? What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty about her exit here. But one thing that we do know for certain is that a Boston Public School superintendent has the shelf life of a can of soup. You know, there have been four just since 2015, two permanent and two interim. So I think that, you know, this is a difficult situation for Mayor Wu to replace not only the school superintendent, but also a police commissioner. And it's going to be difficult to get someone, I think, in place by the beginning of the next school year. So that's hard. But, you know, essentially, this is a really difficult job that that some people are up to and some people are not. I'm not going to pass judgment on Brenda Caselius. I mean, I think she inherited a lot of difficult problems, but it would be nice to bring somebody in, have them stay for a while so that there can be some kind of continuity in terms of addressing the issues that that the school system has.
So here is Caselius herself talking with WCVB when she first accepted the job about how long she intended to stay.
Well, I want to be here for 13 years minimum.
Okay, so obviously not 13 years, but this writing might have been on the wall. I was struck. Adrian Walker of the Boston Globe, he and I moderated a debate at City Space before the preliminary election, and he reminded all of us this week in a column that Mayor Wu had telegraphed how much she did or didn't support Caselius when asked to grade her during that debate.
I'll give a C. We have not truly seen the leadership in the district free from a tumultuous set of circumstances. In the 3 years that Superintendent Caselius has been here, BPS has gone through possibly the hardest period that we have experienced. And so I'm looking forward to working with and digging into school leadership to ensure that the mayor's office is partnering all along the way.
So, Richard, to say neither defending nor not defending Caselius, but mindful that in that 3 years, a significant chunk of it had been in an unprecedented pandemic. Should that factor in and how?
Yeah, it's a tough job. And I would just say the mayor going forward needs to have her own person as superintendent, just like she needs to have her own person as the police commissioner. She's going to sink or swim by how well both of those departments are doing. And, you know, and I would agree with John, you know, if you have a football team that doesn't have a winning record and you go through four coaches in 7 years, you know, you don't really have anybody coming in who's going to be able to turn things around. I mean, it's too much instability. So she really needs to bring in her person. And I would think that, you know, you have so many problems in Boston in the public schools. You have 35%, I'm sorry, three dozen schools right now that are among the lowest performing in the entire state that need a turnaround. They need immediate attention. And, you know, you need somebody who can put a program in place to improve those and stick with it for 3, 4, 5, however long many years it takes to start to see results. So I think the mayor's probably, I don't know how it happened, but it's a good opportunity for her to get her own person in.
We are talking higher education and the reckoning that is or maybe isn't happening. Three women sue Harvard over failure to act on harassment in the anthropology department or failure to sufficiently act. All eyes on Harvard and MIT after one of its superstars resigns as the White House science advisor in a bullying scandal. Join the conversation. Is it a moment of reckoning for higher education here? Do you think our universities will meet the moment, or are they already behind? And what do you want to see happen next? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, so Richard and John, I want to summarize this a little bit. Tough stories on the higher ed front. I'm going to start with Harvard and the sexual harassment story. It's a two-part story. Part one, And Boston Globe reporter Laura Krantz gives an excellent summary, so I'm actually going to quote her here. There is a lawsuit that alleges that Professor John Komaroff, who is of the anthropology department, quote, on more than one occasion forcibly kissed one of the complainants, groped her in public, and graphically imagined her rape and murder aloud. It also alleges that the professor cut the student off from her other professors and derailed her degree process. The complaint says the other two students reported Komaroff to the university and sought to warn other students about him. It alleges that Komaroff retaliated by ensuring the pair would have difficulty finding jobs in their field. He was placed on unpaid leave after an internal Harvard investigation. This lawsuit says does not go far enough. John Carroll, can we judge this from the outside, Harvard's level of response and whether they did or did not miss the moment here?
It's difficult to judge because Harvard's been so opaque about its investigation. It seems to have investigated one of the complaints by the student, but not others. So they have not apparently taken a public position or even a private position with the student on the forcibly kissing, the groping in public. That has sort of, you know, gone by the boards. So I think the instinct at Harvard, and we haven't even talked yet about the faculty members who rushed to Komaroff's defense before they really knew what this was all about and then retracted their defense. The issue is Harvard protecting somebody who's a prominent faculty member, and that's an institutional reflex that we'll see up and down the academic world. And it seems to be continuing as this becomes more and more of a public dispute.
So, Richard, to say I want to stay with the idea of the institutional reflex for a minute. Here is one of the plaintiffs, and we're going to call her Margaret Chirinsky. We looked for a pronouncer on her last name, were unable to find one. If I have mispronounced that last name, I apologize. Here she is on the suit.
The university, despite what it promises us, despite what it says, is actually completely indifferent to harm that befalls students, and they will not take action unless they are absolutely forced to do so by external pressure.
That smacks of things we would have heard about Hollywood, Richard, about the Catholic Church before the Me Too movement, before the child sex abuse scandal was revealed, that until there is outside pressure, large, successful, powerful institutions will circle their wagons. How to think about an idea that it's going to circle its wagons and it takes outside pressure to break that circle?
I think that's true definitely in any sector, and you know, any type of situation in general. I think in this case, the public should really wait until the court case plays out before you know, especially some of the more egregious allegations, before they pass judgment on it. And you know, I kind of, when I saw this originally in the paper, I got a certain impression that, you know, that there were multiple people who came forward and said that they were sexually harassed by this professor. Knowing it was coming up on the show, I reread the article. You know, in the article, the headline of the article, you know, it says that three graduates file sexual harassment suit. But when you actually read the article, it was one student and the other two were speaking up in her defense. So I don't know that necessarily this was a pattern with this particular professor that had gone on for decades. I think we're going to end up finding a lot more out. And I'm not saying that the people who brought the, you know, the case, you know, don't have a plausible, you know, reason to do it. I'm just saying that the public should probably wait and let all the facts play out before they, you know, cancel the entire Harvard, you know, the university for their actions.
And so just to clarify also in the suit, the other two do claim verbal harassment and threatened retribution against their career prospects for speaking up for the woman, the plaintiff accusing Komaroff of sexual harassment. So just to clarify there, I want to now bring in part two, because John Carroll, you referenced it earlier. In its findings during its internal investigation, Harvard found problem with a comment that Komaroff reportedly made to a student about that student's risk of facing sexual violence if she were to carry forward plans to do research on the African continent alongside her same-sex partner. 38 Harvard professors signed a letter in protest over Harvard disciplining Kamerhoff for that, in part saying that it jeopardized their ability to effectively advise their own graduate students. But once this lawsuit came out, 34, as you mentioned, stepped back, saying that they had incomplete facts. Among the signatories who stepped back, some pretty famous scholars, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Paul Farmer, Jill Lepore. The irony is thick there in an academic institution where having your facts right, you know, doing the research is key to the culture. What do we think is going on, John?
Well, again, it's that, you know, reflexive defense of the status quo, reflexive defense of, you know, the people in your tribe. You know, this is very much an issue of, as you said, circling the wagons. People don't like to see precedent set that could affect them. So that's one issue with the faculty members who sent the letter of support for Kamerhoff, was they're thinking about themselves as well, and, you know, how this might affect them. And unfortunately, two of the women have already been adversely affected by this. However this lawsuit plays out, you know, one of them changed her academic focus, and another one switched her dissertation so that she wouldn't have to deal, the subject of her dissertation, so she wouldn't have to deal with Professor Kamerhoff or his wife, who's also in the anthropology department. So their careers have been adversely affected already, no matter how this lawsuit plays out. And that's the unfortunate part. And the imbalance of power here is something that is really hard to avoid, but it's also really hard to overcome.
So I do want to flag Harvard Law School professor Randall Kennedy was one of the four who did not retract his signature, saying, well, listen, my concern about how I might advise a graduate student hasn't changed, and that was the reason I signed. And I'm flagging that because we'll actually have Professor Kennedy here on the show in the last week of the month. We'll talk to him about a range of things, but we'll have an opportunity to ask him about it there, too. Okay, so Richard, to say, before we end on this, there is this other case, Professor Eric Lander. He's been on leave from his posts at both Harvard and MIT, White House science advisor, now resigns over accusations of bullying. And WBUR reporter Yasmin Ammer reporting that neither Harvard nor MIT has said whether he'll continue his positions there. He has resigned from the White House. There's a tenure dimension to all this. Kamerhoff is tenured. Lander has tenure. How does the tenure question complicate things?
Well, I guess, I don't know, you know, I can turn the whole thing up on its head, upside down, and go back to our previous conversation. You know, it really surprises me that many professors, tenured professors at Harvard, would even sign a letter in the first.
Oops, we have lost Richard's sound, and I'm sure we will get Richard back. So I'm going to start you over. We lost your sound for a second there. So surprising that number of people would sign the letter in the first place.
Would Aaron sign the letter in the first place? Number of tenured professors at Harvard would sign that letter in the first place, knowing that if the situation blew up, that, you know, they would risk being the focus would go on them, and they would risk being, being canceled. So, and that's the culture right now in higher ed. And here in this other case in the White House is, I think that people have to be a lot more sensitive right now, as far as bullying goes, you know, with the White House case, to make sure that, you know, especially with more remote, you know, Zoom meetings and stuff like that, a lot more seems to be happening right now, because maybe it's because they're not interacting directly, but, it is a problem.
All right, so to finish out the show, we're going to have a couple of kinds of fun. First, we're going to do our hubbubs, which are those local stories that caught our attention this week. So, Richard Tessay, did you bring us a hubbub?
Yes, actually, I want to just talk about the State House. Two things. First, After 700 days being closed, the Senate president just announced that she's going to try to get people back into the building, the public, on February 22nd. The House has not done that yet, so they're going to have to figure out how to go into the Senate, but you can't go to the House. But outside the building, if you notice the flags, Governor Baker ordered the flags to fly at Haas staff today in honor of Bill Owens, a former state senator who passed away on January 22nd at the age of 84. I served with him for a couple of years in the state Senate. He was a nice guy, first Black state senator, did a lot for equality and racial justice in Massachusetts. So it's great to see him honored that way.
And thank you for giving us a chance to honor him today, too, Richard. I appreciate that. All right. Hubbub from you, John Carroll.
Yeah, my hubbub is actually a heads up for when you're watching the Super Bowl this Sunday. Keep an eye out for a Samuel Adams ad. It features the Brewers' ongoing character, your cousin from Boston, who is drinking and dancing with a bunch of robots from a local engineering firm, Boston Dynamics. Your cousin is annoying as usual, but the robots are pretty fantastic.
All right, so we will watch for that truly vintage Boston ad. Okay, my hubbub comes courtesy of NBC 10 Boston. Thanks to director Amanda Beland for finding it. Our story starts in Chesterville, Maine at a birthday party in 2015 when Ashes the cat goes missing, never comes back. Until now, 7 years later, when Ashes is identified by her microchip 1,500 miles away in Florida, and is returned this week to some very surprised owners. Now, I don't know what happened on those 1,500 miles, but I'm picturing Ashes in a Harold and Kumar kind of adventure, and I got to give Ashes props for making it back after 7 years. All right, so that's my hubbub today. Here we'll say goodbye to Richard Tessay, former Republican leader in the Massachusetts Senate and congressional candidate, and to John Carroll, media analyst. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, now, a special segment to end the week about a serious or at least seriously maddening subject, potholes. Have you hit one this week? Does it feel like giant sections of the road have opened their maws to swallow you whole in an act of vengeance against your automobile? Can you tell that I have feelings about this? So more importantly, how bad is it for your car? We wanted to ask someone, and of course, we're going to ask Ray Malyatsi, former co-host of Car Talk here on WBUR and co-founder and operator of Cambridge's Good News Garage. Ray, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tatiana. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How about those potholes, Ray?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You know, I've got to say, and I'm sure I speak for every repair shop owner, potholes are an answer to a prayer for us. Because potholes wreck your car. And it doesn't take a physicist to figure out that the deeper the pothole and the faster you hit it, the more damage you're going to do to your car.
So what are some of the... No, go.
So, no, I mean, it's logical, right? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. I mean, you hit a pothole at 50 miles an hour, and if it's deep enough, it's going to wreak havoc on your car.
Well, that would total your car, wouldn't it, if you hit a really deep pothole at 50 miles an hour?
Depends how deep it is. Yeah, it might throw your car out of control. Might spin you off into the median strip. I don't know. I've never hit one at that speed. But there are more potholes this year than it seems like ever before.
It does seem like they are worse.
Yeah, it does. And I don't know if the freeze-thaw cycles that we've had have exacerbated it. I don't know what that's all about. But I was just driving on Route 3 in Burlington, and it seems like every 50 feet there's a pothole. And it's especially insidious when we've had thaw and the potholes are filled up with water, because then you really can't see their depth.
So, Ray,
you can't see them until you're practically on top of them.
Let me ask you, what are the typical pothole injuries that you see for automobiles?
Well, if you're lucky and you hit a pothole slightly, you're probably going to knock a wheel weight off, one of your wheels, and it's going to throw it out of balance, and you'll notice a high-speed vibration. Mm. But if, in fact, your car is in bad shape, you might break a ball joint. You could easily break a spring. You could damage your wheel. You could easily damage a tire to the point where it either comes off the rim or gets cut open by the impact with the pothole. So it's caught, and you, needless to say, you're going to throw the car out of alignment if you hit enough potholes. So I don't know what to tell people except to slow down.
So let me ask you this. Some of those, like, if my wheel comes off, I get that. I'm going to know that. But we all know that moment when you see the pothole. It's right. I hope I would. It's too late to veer. You get that sickening thud, and then you wonder if something happened to your car. What should one listen for or check for to know about maybe hidden or you know, less visible damage?
Well, if you break a spring, for example, you're going to know that because the car is going to list to one side and it's going to be almost impossible to drive. If you have broken ball joint, the same thing would be the case. Or if you bent the wheel, you would notice a thump, 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 thump as you went along the road. And, you know, if you hit a pothole and you're worried, you should take it someplace almost immediately if you can and get it checked out. And when I say almost immediately, you're probably going to have to complete your journey. And conditions will determine whether or not you should stop your journey and call a tow truck. You know, if the car is behaving peculiarly, if it's wobbling or swerving or making unusual noises, grinding, you know, everyone knows the noises. And you can't just turn the radio up, you know. You know, it's a nice thing to want to do. But, you know, if you're listening to WBUR, turning the radio up's not going to help. You got to listen to something.
But you
know,
should do really it anyway.
Hard rock.
All right. We are out of,
anyway, right.
That's right. We are out of time. What a treat. Ray Malyatsi, former co-host of WBUR's Car Talk and co-founder and operator of the Good News Garage in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ray, for me, this was a true tee-hee moment. So fun to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a great weekend. Watch for those potholes. All right, folks, you've been listening. You've done it again. You've listened to another hour of Radio Boston. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again on Monday.